Welcome, everyone. Mike Adams here, the founder of Brighteon.com and Brighteon.tv, and we have a special guest in studio with us today here in Austin, Texas. It's Randall Carlson. He's at RandallCarlson.com. He gives tours to some catastrophic geological events that took place in Earth's history, and he's here today to talk about the Younger Dryas Boundary Comet Impact Theory and some other fascinating things about our history and potentially the collapse of previous advanced civilizations on our planet. Randall Carlson, it's an honor to have you on. We had a great interview before. Now you're here in person.
Here I am in person. How did this happen?
It's just providence. I mean,
providence.
Here we are.
Fate. Destiny.
Absolutely. I'm just so thrilled to have you in studio here. Thank you for joining us.
Well, this is
us.
Great. Great little interlude. I mean, we came out here, drove 800-900 miles, and
wow,
got to start driving back tomorrow.
Yep.
And
and you were on with Joe Rogan
mm-hmm.
yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
When does that air, by the way?
I'm not sure yet.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
I should know by the end of the week.
Well, so you probably dropped some bombshells on Joe Rogan, I would imagine.
I would imagine, yes.
What are you gonna give us here today?
Well, some of the things you brought up in the intro remarks would be great material to talk about. You know, what I have been involved in for years is the study of Earth history and how it may have affected not only life on Earth, but the rise and fall of civilizations.
Yep.
And after having immersed myself in this subject matter for over 40 years now, I'm kind of the opinion that that it's really not as widely known, particularly among the scientific community, as it needs to be, particularly
yeah.
among archaeologists, because their models of prehistory are very gradualistic, very uniformitarian, and they don't understand the role that profound geological and astronomical events have played in the history of this planet. And certainly those who are promoting, you know, anthropogenic climate change are completely oblivious to that side of the equation.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that they want to drive us into this human-caused
mm-hmm.
Climate change narrative? But in doing so, they have to eliminate this, all of this evidence and all this history, which is what you specialize in understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to rewrite history and kind of try to blur out these things that are written into the rocks.
Yes, that's exactly how it goes. And just essentially to ignore that, to fill up the dialogue and the debate with what they're doing is they're taking modern events that have been ongoing for thousands of years on any time scale you care to look at it, and exaggerating those as if they are somehow unprecedented. You know, there's a storm, there's a fire, there's a drought, there's a flood, and these are being portrayed as unprecedented, which they are not by any means unprecedented.
Well, right. I think I mentioned this in our last interview that we did when it was a remote interview. And by the way, people love that interview. Get a lot of good feedback. But the narrative that we're given today is as if we're supposed to pretend that before the invention of the combustion engine,
mm-hmm.
that everything in history was serene, calm, spring-like. There were no tornadoes, no hurricanes, no floods, no droughts, nothing. And that is just absurd.
Yeah, it couldn't be farther from the truth. And in fact, what the evidence is overwhelmingly showing now is that a lot of those events that we would think of as extreme climate or weather or meteorological events are actually declining in severity. We can look at accumulated cyclonic energy as far as the oceans are concerned, the Atlantic and the Pacific, typhoons in the Pacific, hurricanes in the Atlantic, and it's actually declined over the last 20 or 30 years. We can look at forest fires. They've declined. We can look at droughts. By any measure that we care to look at, we can see that actually things have kind of calmed down a bit. And when we look back, let's say, at the last millennium or two, what we see is that periods of cold weather, by contrast, have been the ones where the greatest extremity and frequency of these intense events have occurred. And in the podcast that we're doing, which I do, by the way, with my friend and colleague, Brad Young, who's joined us here in the studio today, we are documenting, going through meticulous documentation
yeah.
of the actual history of climate change and the way in which the data is being manipulated to create a false impression.
It seems like, Randall, that there's a sudden amount of renewed interest or brand new interest in this. I think some of that is obviously credited to you because you're talking about this publicly and you're kind of evangelizing the knowledge about this, which I think is wonderful, by the way. But also Graham Hancock and his special on Netflix as well. I think that had a huge impact. How did I can't even believe Netflix greenlighted that thing, by the way.
And you got to wonder, you know, with the blowback that they've gotten from the establishment archaeologists,
right?
Which I don't know how much of that you've seen, but it's I have to call it despicable.
Yeah,
you know, these claims of white racism and or white supremacy and racism and dangerous conspiracy theories. You know, to ask questions about our our past from thousands of years ago, to ask those questions, that's a dangerous conspiracy theory.
How can it be racist to look at evidence of archaeology work to understand it?
Well, the thing that struck me as I was going through a lot of the articles and things that had been written by the critics was over and over again, the same words, the same phraseology. It was clear that, you know, you're not going to get 10 independent critics all watching that and then concluding that it's promoting white supremacy unless somebody is giving him a list of talking points. And they're all looking at that same.
But that just speaks to their lack of intellectual integrity. If
they're absolutely
going to take talking points and just regurgitate that publicly. And also in the context of our woke culture, you know, we've seen accusations that the history of philosophy is white supremacist and racist because so many of the philosophers were, quote, white. But frankly, most of them were European. They would be called immigrants today. If they came to America, they'd be European-American immigrants. But the history of mathematics, the same way. History of astronomy. You know, these accusations are baseless, and they don't carry any weight.
They carry nothing, really, except some kind of an agenda. There's got to be an agenda behind it, and I think ultimately we look at what that agenda is, and it's, dare I say the word, Marxist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but...
But kind of a neo-Marxist. It's not the classical Marxist. It's definitely left-wing, I would think.
But I would also attribute it, I would describe it as working to keep humanity disconnected from who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we understand better who we are or where we came from or what was lost, then we might have more power as individuals or communities to control our own destiny.
And also the fact that if we actually take a realistic look at the history of global change, we see that the changes have been profound. I mean, all you got to do is stop for a minute and think about going back 14, 15,000 years ago to what 20,000 years ago, what would have been called the late glacial maximum. You've got ice sheets, 10, 12,000 feet thick over Canada, reaching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific, from the northern United States to the Arctic Circle. That implies a very different world. Sea levels 400 feet lower because of the massive accumulation of ice on the continents, a completely different biosphere distribution. You've got a flora and a fauna that has gone through profoundly dramatic changes since then. I mean, right here where we are in Texas, you would have had, you would have had mammoths, you would have had giant ground sloths, dire wolves, cave bears, the list goes on, mastodons, and they're roaming around. They were the top of the food chain. And essentially, the transition from glacial age into interglacial, such as we are now, which is called the Holocene, was dramatically catastrophic as far as the megafauna at the time. And planet lost half the great megafaunal species on Earth in that transition zone. And to put that into context, that's half, so it's roughly those that survive that populate the Earth now are roughly the same number of species that went extinct in that transition from glacial to interglacial age.
Wow, okay.
How do you even process that?
But there's no question that this extinction event took place. I mean, no one questions that it happened because the record is there. You can see these animals and plants existed up until this layer.
Yeah.
And then they're gone.
And they're gone.
So there's no question about that. The only debate is about the explanation of what happened.
Yeah.
And what the Comet Research Group does, and I also want to mention the upcoming Cosmic Summit.
Yeah.
Which is an event happening in June, I believe.
June?
In North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Asheville, but also people can access it through live streaming.
Right.
CosmicSummit2023.com for those who want to find out about that. You're speaking there, correct?
Yes.
And Graham Hancock is as well?
Yes, he is.
And can I ask who else is speaking?
Well, let's see. When George comes on and you interview him, he will give you the full lowdown.
Okay, great.
On that. It's a great lineup. Ben Van Kirkwick, Jimmy, Bright Insight Jimmy, who does the, I'm not thinking of his last name. And then we've got, it's kind of going to be an interesting mix that George has put together, because we've got people that might be considered a little bit on the fringe, although their work is solid, all the way to, you know, fully credentialed scientists that have been working on this.
Yeah.
Who are open-minded enough to come to a forum like this and consider a lot of different possibilities.
Well, I think that's fantastic that you're doing this, and we'll talk about it more with George, who's in studio here.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating to me is that you see right now there's pressure being put on Google and the tech giants, mm-hmm, to censor anyone who disagrees with the official climate narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would imagine that kind of effort is, as the Comet Impact Theory group becomes more prominent, you're going to get a lot more pressure from, you know, the quote consensus science community, mm-hmm, to censor you and your speech and your evidence and your papers. Are you already starting to see some of that, or are you anticipating
well,
more?
Well, here's what I think happened, and George is going to elaborate on this, I'm sure. After that 2007 paper, there was kind of a flurry of interest. Wow, this explains a lot. But literally within a couple of months, the pushback started.
And which paper was that?
This was the 2007, An Extraterrestrial Cause for the Megafaunal Extinctions. George, I think, can give you the exact title. It was...
So this was the first one that really put together the Comet Impact Theory.
Yeah, the ideas were floating around out there. In fact, I gave a lecture in 1995 where I was proposing exactly that as one possibility for the megafaunal extinctions.
Uh-huh.
But this was the first scientific paper where you had, I think, 17 authors fully credentialed who were taking a look at this and realizing that there was evidence for some kind of a cosmic impact. Then, within a month or two, you saw the attacks coming, and it was apparent in reading the critics that how could you have fully and legitimately evaluated the evidence that was brought forth in that 2007 paper within a month or two? So it was clear to me that they were just coming from preconceived notions.
Uh-huh. Well, that's part of this, because you're challenging... the existing narrative and the existing papers that have been written by some of those critics.
Yeah.
And, as you know, in the history of scientific revolutions, often what has to happen for ideas to change is for people to retire or pass away to make room for new ideas. But this idea this is an old idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one of the oldest ideas. It predates modern civilization, and it's written in the stones. That's what I can't figure out, why this is even controversial.
Well, it's controversial, I think, because for one reason, if people are going, there have been these catastrophic episodes throughout Earth history, and then you look at the magnitude of these events, and then you look at, with that perspective in mind, you look to what's going on currently, what's happening now doesn't seem all of that significant.
I see.
That's one reason, I think. That's part of it. I think it's also just the conservatism. There's this carryover of gradualism, uniformitarianism is the word, from the 19th century. But you know, almost all of the early founding fathers of geology were catastrophists.
Right.
They looked at the landscapes around them without the preconceptions of a narrative or a dogma. And what they saw, they were interpreting, you know, when they would look at these gigantic river terraces, built of these gravels, massive amounts of gravels, they would go, well, this looks like it must have been a really big flood that produced this terrace here. And of course, what we now know is that it was. And these floods have been all over the world. The focus have mostly been in North America. Bradley and I have been all over the country, back and forth, documenting. God, I don't know what we've got, 10,000 slides, dozens and dozens of footage of drones. We've been up, before drones, we were up in little twin-engine airplanes flying over this stuff, taking videos and photographs and stuff, because some of the things are on such a grand scale that you cannot really comprehend from the ground level. You have right. to be above. You have to be looking.
Makes sense. And that reminds me that you give tours.
Oh, yeah.
And so on your website, randallcarlson.com,
yep.
where people can sign up for... You have a tour coming up later this
we,
year, right?
We have a tour coming up at the end of March. We're going to be in eastern Kentucky looking at some of the things in the east. Now, there's a whole suite of features that were formed through catastrophic flooding in the eastern highlands like Cumberland Plateau and the Appalachian Mountains and things that people don't normally see, because typically it's hidden under the canopy of vegetation.
Right.
So it's not as obvious as when you're in the western states. But there's phenomenal gorges and extinct cataracts and rock arches and natural bridges and huge potholes drilled into the bedrock. The full suite of catastrophic flood features is preserved in many, many geographic locations around the continent. The most spectacular ones, I would have to say, are the Northwest, in Washington, Idaho, and Montana, where you have... you have evidence of peak discharges of 700 or 800 million cubic feet per second in some of these. Now, how do you even wrap your head around something like that? Well, here's one way. You can go, that scale of water flow would be roughly, if you took every single river on Earth from every continent, you can just think of all the big rivers around the world, and you took those rivers, added them all together, and that would be times somewhere between 10 and 20 times the combined flow of all rivers on Earth flowing at once.
Wow.
So, I don't know if you remember, there was a great flood of the Mississippi River in 1993 that was, at the time, the most expensive natural catastrophe uh-huh. in American history. It peak discharges were just over 1 million cubic feet per second. So now you think about 700 or 800 million cubic feet per second. It's almost impossible to imagine. So we take tours to, essentially, the idea is to teach people to see these landscapes and understand what they're looking at. And understand
one of those, Eastern Washington, is that one of the
Yeah, it's one of the areas? That we will be doing that tour in May. There's a May tour coming up. We'll be doing, and then later in the summer, we'll be doing Montana. Yeah, because the flood features that we're looking at are so huge that they extend over three states. So now try to imagine a flood that extends over three states.
Right.
Nothing like that has occurred recently is on that scale.
Yeah. So these tours, it's a small group, I guess, limited number of seats, I suppose.
Yeah, typically we'll do some tour vans, 25 people. Sometimes we'll do tours back to back. We've stayed in a resort at Soap Lake, Washington now for several of these tours, where we kind of rent the whole resort, and it's a series of cabins at the south end of Soap Lake, Washington, if anybody wants to look it up. And we will use that as a base, and then we'll do day trips out from there to examine these things. And then leading up to the tour, we'll do a series of briefings. We'll do like a Zoom meetings where I'm teaching people about the features of the landscape that we're going to be looking at, learning the terminology. So, if I'm out on the, we're out on the tour and I say, okay, over here to our left is a streamlined erosional residual.
Mm-hmm.
They know what I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Right. So some education and then hands-on or boots on the ground.
Yes, boots on the ground out there.
Can people bring drones and fly the drones?
They are welcome to bring drones. Then we have to take it site by site. Some of the places drones are perfectly legitimate to use. Other places it's more restricted.
I see, okay.
But people can bring their drones, and they usually do.
They do?
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. That's really cool. So do you think that – is there something that's changed in our culture right now about – especially since COVID, and I think for the first time in a lot of people's minds, there's a realization that big things can go wrong in society. Do you think that that cultural awareness has, in a way, made people more open to ideas of other catastrophism type of events?
Well, that's an interesting idea that I haven't really considered, but now that you bring it up, I could certainly see that that's plausible.
And it seems like, if I could add, there are more data points. Like yesterday, Pakistan's entire national power grid failed for 12 hours, the whole country. This morning, the New York Stock Exchange went down, and it cratered for, I don't know, a couple hours or something like that, because when it opened, there was a flurry of sell orders, and they shut it down, you know, they shut it down. And things, the FAA, all commercial aircraft were grounded like 10 days ago because of a glitch.
Yeah.
And we keep, all of us experiencing this interesting world, we keep seeing more and more evidence of things failing, like big things failing, like civilization level catastrophes.
That could be a harbinger. Now, here's the thing to keep in mind. Even if we look at the lesser catastrophes in Earth history, like now I'm talking specifically, let's say, about the Holocene, which is generally now dated fairly precisely to have begun about 11,600 years ago. And that's right at the end of the Younger Dryas. So the Younger Dryas was a 12 to 1300 year period that seems to be bookended by catastrophes. And the model now seems to suggest that there was a series of major events affecting the Earth one after another for a very short, compressed period of time. By the time that series of events was over, the entire landscape of the planet had been dramatically altered. Okay, so within the Holocene itself, after these extreme mega-scale events had finally settled down, there are changes within the Holocene, most specifically within the last millennium. Now, if you look at the early Holocene, roughly from 7,000 to 10,000 years ago, it used to be called the climatic optimum, because it's the evidence suggests, based on the elevation of the growth of trees, the migration of plants and animals suitable to habitats, the level of the sea, a lot of proxy evidence that would suggest that the climatic optimum was maybe up to 2 degrees warmer than present, which has been conveniently ignored and kind of eliminated by statistical manipulation.
Right.
And then that was terminated by an event that's usually called the neoglaciation, which occurred between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago, depending on where you were. It wasn't a sudden all over the planet at the same time, but it was a fairly dramatic cooling that took the planet down to actually, you know, cooler than it is now. And then there was kind of, it oscillated back and forth, and then you had a series of warm periods, Roman warm period that saw the proliferation of the Roman Empire. Then that was followed by a Dark Ages cold period that saw the collapse and decline of civilization. Because when you have cold coming on, what happens, in contrast to when it's warm, is that when it's warm, you have a longer growing season.
Well, exactly. You have food abundance.
You have food abundance. So people are well fed.
Population.
Yes. So we see that there was actually population declines, an increase in infant mortality, a decrease in lifespan, even a diminishment in stature of people during this Dark Ages, which you can actually pinpoint, excuse me, about 536 to 540 AD.
Really?
There was a major flip in, and but there's, yeah, so the, then it got cold up until about 1000 AD, and then we went into the medieval warm period. Sea levels rose a couple of feet. It was warmer than now. You had, this was the time when Greenland was colonized, right? It was people farming up on the west coast of Greenland where it's permafrost now.
So if cold periods in human history clearly cause a reduction of harvest and crop yields and hardship for humans and die-offs of certain areas or even certain civilizations, why is it that today, you know, the mainstream narrative being pushed is that they want the Earth to be colder, and the they talk about how they want climate, or I'm sorry, they want habitat for animals, but not ocean animals, because deeper oceans, higher ocean levels relative to land would mean more water volume, which is habitat for whales and dolphins and all these creatures that we're told we're supposed to, you know, care about. And I do care about them. The oceans are critical. But the climate cult, as I call it, wants oceans to be low, to destroy marine habitat, and for more ice, so water locked up in ice where plants can't use it to grow, and which would mean shorter growing seasons, as you said, lower crop yields, and it would devastate human populations today, especially in more marginalized developing nations where every calorie is critical for survival. How are they pushing a suicide wish? I mean,
I don't have an answer for that. I imagine it's multiple factors, but you know, I really can't answer that. Partially, it's ignorance. People just don't have any perspective on how the real world works and how it has worked. You know, that 536 is sometimes I've read in some of the papers that it may have been the coldest year of the last 2,000 years. By 542 AD, with the repeated collapse of crops, agricultural failures, you had, you know, people starving and you had famine, and then people's immune systems get compromised. And then in 542 AD, you had the Justinian Plague that just decimated the population of Europe. With the onset of the medieval warm period, all that was reversed. And you see that there was actually studies showing that human stature increased because people are eating more. There was an abundance of food. Population grew. So between roughly 1000 AD and about 1150 AD, the population had grown, of Europe had grown wealthy enough that they could now embark on this incredible cathedral building enterprise that lasted for the next 120 to 150 years. And you can actually look at that and realizing that, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of highly trained, skilled craftspeople, from, you know, engineers to sculptors to stone workers to carpenters to erect the, you know, the formwork that had to be done. If you're going to put up a 120-foot high vault, you know, that requires a very elaborate formwork. The importation of huge amounts of timber and stone. And so, and that then required the entire society support infrastructure.
Right, right. To have that level of specialization in a society, it speaks to the size and the abundance of the greater society. Because to have a specialist, that person cannot farm. That person cannot be a full-time farmer, I should say. So somebody else is growing the food. There has to be excess food in order to feed the specialists, whether they be physicists or architecture specialists or war, politics, other kinds of specialists, whatever. Right? So that speaks to the abundance of food. But in the reverse situation, as you were saying earlier, as food supplies dwindle, you get a collapse of the specialization of society. You get geopolitical upheavals, you get war, and you get mass migration, which also tends to cause wars throughout history.
That's right.
And it's almost as if the powers that be right now want global conflict or something.
It almost seems like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like they want more migration, they want more conflict, they want clashing of societies.
Right. We can see that, you know, the medieval warm period came to an end in the late 1200s, early 1300s, and that was the first phase of the so-called Little Ice Age. And you can see that the cathedral building era ends almost synchronously with the onset of the cold. And it was around, 1340, in the mid-1340s, after multiple agricultural failures, you had the same cycle repeated itself. You had people's weak immune systems compromised, and then you had the onset of the bubonic plague. And that completely ended the prosperity of European civilization. It ended the cathedral building era. And so the Little Ice Age lasted. There was a sort of a break in the middle. It's sort of two-phased, is what the evidence now suggests. That break was pretty much where we see the Italian Renaissance. And then it got cold again. The cold lasted until about the mid-19th century. And interestingly, the cold of the Little Ice Age began to ameliorate pretty much right about the same time the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And so, but it's also interesting that we see the climate begin to warm around 1850, and it's been warming in a linear, mostly linear fashion since 1850. And prior to World War II, you can't really blame that warming on carbon dioxide, because there just wasn't enough in the atmosphere to have a discernible effect. And what's interesting, though, is the hottest decade of the 20th century was the 1930s. We still have half of all-time record high temperatures in half the states of the U.S. were set in the 1930s. Yeah. And
I also say, what's wrong with warmth? Yeah. I mean, warmth. If we have a warmer planet, we get more evaporation of water from oceans. You get more rainfall inland. You can support more fauna species inland. So you have deserts turned into grasslands or forests. Mm-hmm. You have longer growing seasons. Okay, so the water level rises on the coast, but you get so much more benefit of being able to produce food and survive.
And even though the rising of sea level has been pretty much fairly uniform since the mid-19th century, we don't see any evidence that there was an acceleration of sea level rise.
And it's been so minuscule, but we're shown images that the Statue of Liberty is underwater.
That's just a fantasy.
Which is absurd.
That's a fantasy.
Yeah.
And
you would have to sink it.
Yeah, it's a fear-mongering fantasy is what it is.
Right.
And, interestingly, from the 1940s to the 1970s, right when we started ramping up as a result of fossil fuel burning, when we started pumping a little bit more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the climate actually cooled. And so by the 1970s, you might remember that the fears were the onset of another ice age, right? And that was had some basis in actual evidence in that the climate had cooled between the 40s and 70s. Then in the 80s, it began to warm again. And personally, I think we have to look towards the sun as the primary driver of that. And, when the planet cools and the oceans, after a certain lag period of time, the oceans cool, carbon dioxide becomes much more soluble and is drawn into the oceans. The oceans begin to, cool oceans suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, just like if you have think of a soda can here. If you set it here, you take the top off, right? The carbon dioxide is going to come out, and it's going to get flat, right? Now, also imagine you've got two identical cans of soda side by side. You pop the tops off of them. Both of them are going to begin to outgas CO2, but if you put one in your refrigerator and one you leave just at room temperature, the one at room temperature is going to get flat a lot quicker because it's outgassing much quicker. so anyways, during the Ice Age, now this is interesting. During the Ice Age, the ambient concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere got as low as 180 parts per million.
Whoa.
Now, drop it 30. Now, right now, it's a little over 400 parts per million. If we look at the long term of Earth history going back to Cambrian time, 600 million years in round numbers, we are now in the greatest carbon dioxide deficit in the entire span of time that life has been on the Earth.
Yeah.
And if you go back to 180 parts per million, you drop it another 30 parts per million to 150 parts per million, you know what happens?
We're going to lose, all the plants that rely on carbon
dioxide. That's the death of the biosphere.
Right. And then from there, all the animals die and all the humans die. It's
exactly.
It's a dead ice ball planet at that point.
This planet was dangerously low in carbon dioxide during the late glacial maximum. And through our industrial processes, we've ramped it up a few hundred parts per million. And we're still not to where typically it's been throughout the ages of life on Earth, which is usually 1,000 parts per million and up.
But, you know, the EPA declared carbon dioxide a pollutant, as you know, and we have these programs now across the Midwest of carbon sequestration, these giant machines that are sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere, turning it into liquid form, and putting it underground, piping it underground to put it there. And I've actually equated this to what aliens would do if they were terraforming a planet to try to kill the current species. They would alter the atmosphere, suck all the CO2 out of it, kill all the plants, and just sterilize the planet and start over.
Start over.
Like that movie Oblivion with Tom Cruise and Morgan Freeman. But it's so crazy, it's like science fiction.
It is. It is. And so unnecessary. You know?
Yeah, but, right.
And we are, you know, Bradley and I are doing a whole series of our Cosmographia podcast right now where we're really taking a deep dive into all of this.
Good.
With the referencing the papers, the authors, the graphs, all of this so that people can actually get a handle on it and to try to counter the narrative, this constructed narrative that's being put out there. And it's scaring the crap out of so many young people who just have been spoon-fed this scenario their whole lives.
They are terrified. The children have been psychologically terrorized by the climate narrative.
And the thing is, it's all going to be rendered irrelevant soon because there are whole new energy technologies waiting in the wing. And we're going to be affiliated with that and promoting that. And there will be links on our website, but people can go to strikefoundation.earth to learn more about this remarkable new energy technology, which it may turn out to be is actually a very ancient technology.
Well, and I want to interview the creator of that, the primary person who you've introduced me to, so
sure.
Thank you for that. But we're very interested in that. Because I believe that our cosmos is filled with energy. In every cubic centimeter of space, there is energy potential if we're smart enough to tap into it.
Yeah.
But don't we also have to pair that with a culture that is responsible enough to use energy in some way other than just killing everything and killing each other?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you give people unlimited energy right now, we don't have a mature leadership species here at the moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We're, you know, some of us, like myself, I try to stay optimistic in spite of a lot of signals that would suggest otherwise. I think that truth is going to prevail over falsehood. Good is going to prevail over evil. I have to believe that. That's part of my working philosophy of life. And I want to just do all I can to... You know, I say, people ask me, you know, if I have a philosophy of life, and I say it can be summed up in three words. And this is, you know, you got to have three legs to hold up a stool. And it's peace, freedom, and truth. Peace, freedom, and truth.
Yeah.
And that's the crux of my philosophy. And almost you can't have one without the other.
Good point.
You know?
Yeah. And they help defend each other.
Yes.
And they're all under attack.
And they're all under attack.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, so just to summarize this here, for people who want to learn more and follow you, randallcarlson.com.
Yep.
You also have HowTube.
Yeah. Can you
tell us about that for a minute?
Okay, HowTube was started by my friend Mike Robertson about 3 or 4 years ago now. It was actually in the conceptual work for years leading up to it. But we've been working together now for going on about 2 years. HowTube is a hosting site that's curated, but it's very oriented towards First Amendment and the dissemination of ideas. And we've gone from, I was the first content creator under the umbrella. It's well over 100 now and growing. And it looks like, you know, some major investment money is coming in the next few months, which is going to allow us to take it to the next level.
Nice.
And what we would really are hoping to do is to kind of coordinate our efforts with similar efforts that are taking place around the world, because I think we need a global freedom network to evolve in the next few years.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
I really want to learn more about that, and maybe there's some collaboration between Brighteon and HowTube. We can help get some of your content out there.
Excellent.
Also, then, you're speaking at the CosmicSummit2023.com.
Yes.
Coming up in June.
And then in April, there's going to be Earth Origins Conference in Arizona.
Oh, okay. And then you've got tours.
And then we've got...
Multiple tours.
We've got three tours now that are scheduled. One for late March. This is going to be the Upper Cumberland Tour. We're also going to visit the only Middlesboro, Kentucky, which is the only proven town in North America that's built entirely within an impact crater.
Oh, wow.
Which is very interesting. And so we've got getting special access to some sites in there where you'll be able to... And the Middlesboro impact crater, the eastern rim of it, is the Cumberland Gap, which played a very important role in American history because this is where the settlers were able to pass from east to west across the Appalachian Mountains. And that gap is actually just an open fault line in the rim of this five-mile astrobleem or crater.
Wow.
So, you know, we're going to explore some stuff like that. And then the May tour is the Channel Scab Lands, which are just the spectacular sculpted landscapes of these inconceivably giant floods. And then in late summer, I don't have the exact date, September, we'll be going to the western side of this because this flood phenomena reaches from western Montana all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And we'll see. We don't have anything scheduled for an official tour, but we've done a lot of exploration up in Canada because that is where I believe the melting occurred, because I think the hypothesis we're exploring here is that these tremendous floods that can be found all over the United States were triggered by a series of cosmic impacts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you are a busy man, and I love what you're doing. And I really encourage people to check out your website, your tours, your speeches, you know, the Cosmic Summit that we're gonna talk to George about that as well. But thank you for being here. Thank you for all that you're doing. We really appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, Mike, and it's a great pleasure to meet you finally.
Absolutely.
After all these years.
No, I love your work. I'm a fan of what you're doing, and I'm just thrilled to have you here. You're so busy, I don't even know when you're gonna have a chance to be back this way, but whenever you're back in Texas, you're welcome here, so we'll do it again sometime in the future.
I think so, and when I come back, I'd like to bring a few, you know, juicy things to look at.
Oh, okay, we'd love that.
Yeah,
we'll put a camera on it.
Yeah.
And we'll get you into some other studios around here as well.
Sure, I've got maps and graphics and photos and drone footage and aerial footage.
Nice.
We could put together a very interesting program.
Okay, we'll do that.
All right.
All right, Randall Carlson, everybody. The website is randallcarlson.com, spelled just like it sounds, but with two L's.
Two L's.
Two L's, okay. And, of course, I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com, the platform that we built so that we can have uncensored conversations just like this one. Feel free to repost this interview on your own channels on other platforms. You have our permission to do so. Just give credit to Randall Carlson here at randallcarlson.com and join his tours if you want to have a real adventure in the real world. Get off the screens and go to the 3D world and see the universe around you and how we got here. That's the way to go. Thank you all for watching. Again, I'm Mike Adams. Take care, everybody.